Welcome to the new State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind.
I'm Joseph Pache.
And I'm Grace Wan. This is your weekly conversation about where we live.
And what matters most. We are live.
And we are local.
Every Monday night.
Right here on KALW.
Welcome to State of the Bay, and thanks for joining us tonight. I'm Grace Wan.
And I'm Ethan Elkind.
On tonight's show, we're talking about the governor's recall election. In-person voting opens tomorrow. We'll get the latest on Governor Newsom's prospects and hear about potential reforms to the recall process.
And then we'll hear from Don Reed about his new one-man show, Going Out, now playing at the Marsh Theater in Berkeley.
But first, let's get an update from Chronicle Education reporter Jill Tucker on the search for the city's new school superintendent. Jill Tucker, welcome back to State of the Bay.
Thanks for having me.
So, Jill, Superintendent Vince Matthews delayed his retirement. He's now leaving at the end of this year. The district is looking for a new superintendent. Can you, first of all, explain what a superintendent does, why the position is important, and how the search process is going?
Yeah, so the superintendent is the administrator of the school district. He's not elected, but he is hired by the school board, or she, and then basically runs the school district. The superintendent oversees the entire staff, implements the policies that are passed by the school board, and basically is sort of the CEO, the person who runs the district. In this case, Dr. Matthews, after 5 or 6 years here, is leaving, and they need to find a new one by the end of the year.
And so who would want this job, given all the controversy and struggles in the San Francisco school district?
Well, there's the big question, right? I think many of these searches go to search firms. I've been around long enough and have watched many superintendent searches. It's always a little bit of a game show of guessing and all of those types of things to figure out who might be in consideration. Typically, they do a national search for people, in this case, they brought Vince Matthews. It'll be 6 years ago when he leaves. To come in, he actually was from San Francisco, had a history of being here. And now they're going to be doing a national search for somebody to replace him. It's a long and drawn out process. The question of who wants it will be the big, huge issue for this school board. I have talked to a lot of people in the city, outside the city, have sort of pinged some people that I know to see if they are interested in the job. I've talked to people, in the education world that question whether anybody of quality will want it, given all the controversy that has been in the district and concerns over the school board's power over the superintendent. Superintendent certainly has had complaints in terms of interacting with the school board. In fact, he agreed to stay if they would update his contract and they would agree to abide by certain conditions and abide by their own policies. So, that's a big question. I don't have the answer for you. Who's going to want it? We'll see.
Well, you mentioned the controversy around the school board, and let's talk about the efforts to recall those school board members. I mean, it's recall city everywhere in California these days. Three board members, including Allison Collins, whose lawsuit against the district was recently dismissed, they're targeted for recall. What's the latest on that?
Yeah, so the recall proponents just submitted the signatures for all of those school board members, the three school board members. They have about 30,000 more signatures than they need for each one. So the general sense is that a recall is virtually inevitable at this point, and we would probably see it sometime in January or February. That means, depending on the outcome of such an election, we're going to have different people that actually could be then choosing the superintendent. Though anyone recalled would be replaced by an appointee that the mayor chooses. And so it would be really interesting to see. It's not quite a majority, but out of a 7-member board, 3 people is a lot if they're all recalled in that election. So that recall is definitely going to have an impact on who becomes superintendent. It could have an impact on who wants to become a superintendent here. So there's a lot of chess pieces moving about the board right now in terms of how all of this ends up.
Why were those three board members targeted for recall?
They were the only ones eligible.
Oh.
The simple answer, right? The people supporting the recall said that they would have loved to have put all of them through a recall process, but you have to serve a certain amount of time before you can be recalled. So these were the only ones eligible.
Well, before we move off the school board members, I wanted to pick up Allison Collins' lawsuit. That's a lawsuit she filed against the city and certain board members alleging defamation regarding certain tweets that she'd made in that controversy. But the lawsuit itself cost the school district $110,000 to defend. Will she have to pay that money back to the district at this point, or what's going to happen?
You know, we're still waiting to see. The district could pursue that funding, to recoup the legal fees and costs. It's at least $110,000, but they said there were still bills outstanding. So we don't know the exact amount yet. But they could pursue a slap suit, meaning that it was a frivolous lawsuit, and get her to pay back the legal costs. So far, I've talked to two school board members who don't support that. A lot of them are remaining mum right now about that. So we'll have to see if the district on their own, the superintendent, decides to pursue those, or if that will be a decision that the school board makes behind closed doors. And right now, we just don't know yet.
And Jill, I have to ask about the recall. Aren't these board members up for re-election next year anyways? I mean, how much time are we really depriving them of their time in office if they are up for election in November of next year?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, if they're recalled in January or February, it's well, they would serve typically they would serve out the rest of the year. So we're talking probably 11 months, give or take, of their term. But in the past, those serving on the school board are typically reelected because people they have their ballot and they say, oh, this person is already a school board member, so I'm going to vote for them. It's very rare that someone currently serving on the school board, an incumbent, is not reelected. So the reality is, you know, that's the question. If they are recalled, they would be pulled with about 11 months left on their term because they would serve out through December. But it would also mean that they are no longer, you know, a candidate as an incumbent.
Mm-hmm. Well, definitely recall fever. And, of course, we're going to talk about the Governor Newsom recall later. So it sounds like we should just be booking recall shows for the rest of State of the Bay this year or next year, it sounds like. But I did want to turn to COVID. And there are so far no recorded cases of COVID in the schools. And the teachers' union and the district are in relative agreement about the protocols. So how are the mandatory vaccination requirements going so far in the school district?
Yeah. So to be clear that there are cases in the school district, there's a little over 230. There's no confirmed cases of in-school transmission. So just to clarify, it means that those cases are thought to have come from homes and from the community and not acquired in the schools. So that's so far good news. Coming up, any adults not vaccinated will be subject to weekly testing. So there is no, in the school district right now, there is no mandatory vaccination for adults or children. The adults have the option of testing, and there is nothing, no policy right now for children. LA just passed their mandatory vaccination policy for children starting in January, and there's a lot of questions whether that would withstand a legal challenge since it's still an emergency youth authorization for children 12 to 17. So far so good in the district is what I'm hearing from health officials in the city, that that the odds of getting COVID in schools is much lower than in the community at large. They don't do weekly testing like some districts do of every person in the district. It's pretty expensive, at least $30 per test. So right now they're testing for symptomatic. There is the option of asymptomatic testing at certain schools and certain locations. But right now, in terms of children hospitalized and children in terms of transmission in schools, no children were in the hospital for COVID last time I checked last week on Friday. And there have been no cases of outbreaks in schools, which means three cases connected in 2 weeks or any in-school transmission. So, you know, I think a lot of health officials are saying so far so good. Let's keep our fingers crossed.
Well, I certainly hope that that stays positive, those stats. And let's talk a little bit about the teachers in the classroom. And, you know, last year there was very little, if no, in-classroom teaching. And in August, there was a shortage of teachers. Many classes were expected to start the year with subs. Have those positions been filled? And is this a city problem or is this a state problem?
This is a national problem. And so you are really seeing the shortage of teachers and the shortage of substitutes, something that we were already seeing before the pandemic. It really has gotten even more difficult, as one might imagine. You're seeing it in other sectors of the economy where people are retiring or they're just choosing to simply not go back to work, et cetera. So we're definitely seeing that in the schools. In fact, stay tuned, working on it, but we'll see. You know, I'm taking a look overall, but San Francisco is certainly not immune to that, and they are seeing shortages. Last I checked, they had, and again, it's kind of rotating, right? Because you can have somebody resign or go on maternity leave or something like that. So it's always a rotating number, but there were about, if memory serves, about 40 positions that were not filled by permanent people. But again, a lot of those had recently come open. You know, you're seeing positions that were open that are filled and then new positions open up. So, but it is a struggle to fill those. It's a struggle for special education, for bilingual education, and for other positions in the district in San Francisco and across the entire Bay Area.
Yeah, so that's something that you're seeing in different school districts like Oakland, Alameda, and the like.
Absolutely. Yeah. There are some districts where, you know, they don't have enough subs for half of the requests that they're getting each day. You know, and so they might, you know, it might be in the realm of they have 100 requests and only 50 subs to fill. And so they have to fill those with administrators and other types of positions, you know, and that may be because a teacher is out on quarantine or they're just, you know, sick for the day with a cold, because obviously, if you even have one sniffle, you're supposed to stay home. And so that's leaving a lot of daily vacancies for substitutes, and then as well as the permanent vacancies as well. There's a lot going on.
Thank goodness you're here. Thank goodness you're here, Jill Zucker, to get us all up to date.
Thank you.
So, Jill, I also want to ask about students, and the school district has experienced a loss of enrollment since the pandemic. Have those numbers rebounded, and what are the implications of fewer students in the classroom?
Yeah, so far, based on the first counts of the year, the district is under 50,000 for the first time in as long as I can remember, a long time, and down about 5% from 2020 levels. And, you know, and a lot of districts are seeing this. Oakland is seeing, you know, a loss as well. It'll remain to be seen whether this rebounds, you know, once things truly go back to normal. The Delta, I think, threw everyone for a loop, and a lot of people chose to keep their kids home. You know, some of the independent learning and distance learning options are not what parents are looking for. They couldn't get into the program that they wanted. So, you know, perhaps they're going elsewhere or homeschooling right now. But yeah, we definitely have seen a decline of enrollment across the state and in districts like San Francisco. The district has lost, the state has lost an awful lot of kids as well. And I don't remember the particular numbers, but it's in the hundreds of thousands since the pandemic started.
So I would gather this is really going to exacerbate inequality in the state I'm assuming that this is maybe wealthier families that are able to pull their kids out for homeschooling if they're at home able to teach their kids or pay for private schooling. Is that accurate?
You know, it really is across the board. I've talked to a lot of families, some that are low income, many in the Chinese American communities that, you know, they might be in SROs, but they don't want to send their kids into the schools right now and are homeschooling. So you really are seeing a widespread, you know, depending on the community, depending on the family, what choices they're making, whether they're choosing to go to private schools or whether they're choosing to homeschool. You know, so there really is no specific demographic in terms of those going to the schools for in-person learning and those that have left the public system. It's kind of all over the map. But ultimately, funding is attached to the number of kids that are attending in a school district. And it's, you know, 15,000 or more per kid that you might get from the state. And so when you think about a loss of students in a district like San Francisco that's facing a massive 100 million plus deficit next year, any loss of students could have a significant impact on their financial stability.
Well, Jill, in the minute that we have left, what's a story we should be keeping an eye on and thinking about as the fall semester continues?
Oh my gosh, of the 40 million that are out there.
Yes, but I mean, what as a parent who has a kid in the school district, what should I be thinking about?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going to see districts continue to adapt to the pandemic and try to figure out where the needs are. I think, you know, in general, I think folks are looking for more testing, and the fact that Los Angeles is requiring vaccinations, we're going to be seeing more of that. I think we're really going to be looking at where the case numbers are going and if we're seeing in-school transmission. And hopefully we're going to see, you know, these positions filled. I'm looking at how kids are doing and their mental health. And, you know, and so far in the schools that I've been to, I see a lot of happy kids. So, you know, I'll be looking at that as well, how they're doing, how they're getting along as they keep moving forward.
Well, it's always great to have you on State of the Bay, Jill, because you give us such a good update on what's happening. So, and we'll have to leave it there. Thank you for joining us, Jill Tucker. She's the education reporter for The Chronicle.
Thank you.
And coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll talk to reporter Emily Hoven of Cal Matters and UC Berkeley Law School's Dean Erwin Chemerinsky about the Newsom recall election happening tomorrow. That's right after this break.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan.
And I'm Ethan Elkind. We want you to be a part of this next conversation. We're going to be talking about the recall election that will end tomorrow. Do you feel Governor Newsom deserves this recall election? And if so, what are you voting? Who are you voting for? And do you think the rules around recalls should be changed? Should recalls be stopped altogether?
Give us a call. We're at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or send us a message on Twitter. We're at State of Bay. Or send us an email, stateofthebay@kalw.org.
So now to talk about the state of the recall, we're very pleased to be joined by Emily Hoven, who writes the daily What Matters newsletter for Cal Matters. Welcome, Emily.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
And we're also pleased to be joined by Erwin Chemerinsky, Jesse H. Choper, Distinguished Professor of Law, and my dean, where I work full-time at the UC Berkeley School of Law. So welcome, Dean Chemerinsky.
Delighted to be here.
Well, Emily, let's start with you. At the risk of asking the obvious question, remind us again, why is Governor Newsom being subjected to this recall?
Yeah, that's the question of the century. But, you know, back before the pandemic, there was a group of voters who were pretty disaffected with the governor's policies on immigration and a whole host of other issues. And so they started gathering signatures using one of those processes in California's constitution to knock someone out of office if enough voters vote to do so. And the project was not really getting a lot of momentum until the pandemic hit and until the governor's infamous dinner at the French Laundry. And that really galvanized a lot more people to sign the petition and ultimately was enough to get the required amount to force a special election.
And Emily, what's the latest on the polling that you've seen? What can we expect tomorrow?
Well, the polls are showing that he has a double-digit lead and is, you know, very likely to remain in office. And that's a pretty dramatic switch from where we were less than 2 months ago when some of the polls were predicting that it was basically going to be a tie and it could really go either way. But paradoxically, those polls showing kind of a negative thing for the governor really served to amplify his Democratic base, and they, you know, start raising lots of money, start mobilizing Democratic voters, and they have really managed to turn things around. obviously, you know, polls are not necessarily, you never know what's going to happen. I think politics is crazy. Politics is crazy. So that's what we're saying. But we're going to see how things turn out tomorrow.
Well, I think that there's a part of the electorate that has polling PTSD. So, you know, despite what the polls might say, they might not think that that's the case. Just let's go through some of the basics. How do you get to the poll? How can you vote if you haven't voted already?
Yeah, so every single active registered voter in the state should have gotten a ballot in the mail. And if you have not turned in that ballot yet, you can either by dropping it in the mailbox, as long as it's postmarked by September 14th, tomorrow it will be counted. You can also drop it off in a ballot box, which are at, you know, numerous locations in each county and throughout the state. And you can also go to your polling place and vote in person. And if you are not yet registered to vote, but you want to vote, you can register tomorrow, the day of the election, and cast a provisional ballot. So California does try to open up as many avenues as possible for people that want to, you know, get involved in democracy and cast a vote. And, you know, obviously we encourage everyone to do that, like make your voice heard. That's what this is all about.
Well, Emily, I noticed for the first time ever, every voter in California was sent a ballot. And so how has that process gone so far?
Yeah, so we're seeing so far that Democrats have returned about over 50% of the ballots so far, which is kind of a trend that we saw start to emerge in the 2020 presidential election, where many Democrats chose to, you know, vote by mail because of the pandemic. And then many Republicans, many of whom sort of listened to former President Donald Trump's claims that that was a fraudulent process, decided to vote in person. And so although a lot of Democratic strategists right now are pretty happy seeing the high return from Democrats, there is this possibility of, you know, a Republican landslide tomorrow if that's the vast majority of people who go to the polls. But, you know, some pollsters are saying that it's getting harder and harder mathematically to see the governor being ousted just because of the sheer amount of Democrats that are turning out. But then again, not all Democrats are going to vote to keep Newsom in office. So again, our picture right now is kind of opaque. But I do think the Newsom campaign is feeling as good as they could be right now.
Well, let's bring in Erwin Chemerinsky. He's the dean of UC Berkeley Law School. I mean, Erwin, for the listeners who haven't read your op-ed piece of the New York Times, you argued that this recall was unconstitutional. Why?
If Gavin Newsom loses, he'll end up with 48 or 49%. The second vote will then be on who replaces him. And right now, the front runner is about 25%. So what we would have happen is somebody who's favored by 25% of the voters will become governor, and somebody who's favored by 48 or 49% will be removed from office. My colleague Aaron Edline argued that's not only nonsensical, it's unconstitutional.
And Dean Chemerinsky, you recommended a fairly simple solution to this problem that you've identified with the recall. So can you explain to listeners what that solution might be?
Well, there are many solutions. What it would be right now is simply make the lieutenant governor the governor if Newsom is removed. In fact, if Newsom loses tomorrow, there will be lawsuits, I'm sure, filed on Wednesday on exactly this theory. And the remedy at that stage would be whoever is the lieutenant, well, we've got a lieutenant governor, becomes the governor. Now, there are other remedies, too. We could change the way this is structured. So Newsom is on the second vote. And if Newsom would get the most votes, he would stay in office. It's obviously too late for that now that so many people have voted and others will vote tomorrow.
Well, staying with that lawsuit, a federal judge in Los Angeles rejected the argument and ruled that the recall is, in fact, constitutional. What's your response to that judgment?
It was a different theory than the one that Aaron Edline and I advanced in our op-eds. And so Judge Fitzgerald's ruling was not on the theory that we're advancing. I do know that there are lawyers who have prepared so that if Newsom should lose, they would then file a lawsuit focusing on the theory that Professor Edline and I have argued for.
And is it the right place to decide, you know, the constitutionality? Is it the courts or should we be reforming the Constitution? You know, it's just a question of where should this question be resolved?
For this election, it's the courts if it's necessary, because the process has to comply with the Constitution. When the recall is done tomorrow, and there's every reason to believe, as was said, that Gavin Newsom will stay in office, we need to focus on reforming the recall process. For example, under California law, it only takes 12% of the voters at the last election to get a recall on the ballot. That's far too low. There's 19 states that have recall elections. Most require a third or even 40% of those who had voted at the last election. If there's going to be a recall, we should schedule it the next regularly scheduled election, not at a random Tuesday in September. And I think we should change the structure so that either the governor would appear on the second list and stay in office and get the most votes, or simply if the governor's recalled, lieutenant governor takes over. California's procedures are unlike any other state, and we now need to change them.
All right. Well, I wanted to ask Emily about, in addition to Gene Chemerinsky's questions about the constitutionality of the recall process, there also just seems to be broader interest in some of the reforms that Dean Chemerinsky mentioned. Do you have any indication that the legislature might take up some of these reforms in the coming year based on what we've seen this year?
I think it's pretty much 100% that some of those reforms are going to be considered. The legislative session just ended last Friday, and you had both the leaders of the Assembly and the Senate saying, yeah, you know, we're seeing a lot of desire to look at those processes and maybe consider them anew. And they haven't really been looked at, you know, in a long time. And so I think that's part of it. Obviously, also, I think it scares the Democratic legislature that they could lose a Democratic governor. And I want to point out in regard to the timing of the election as well, that the legislature moved the timing of it. It could have been later. It could have been in November when people are more used to having an election. Granted, it is an off year. But they chose to move it up predominantly because they wanted to do everything they could to keep the governor, you know, in office. And they thought having it earlier would allow him to avoid some of the risks like a COVID surge, wildfires. Obviously, we've seen both those things happen very early this year with the Delta variant and with all these wildfires going on. So it's not as if they don't have some level of control over some of the things that are happening in the state. But yeah, I think you definitely are going to see a lot of movements. And there's, like the dean was saying, there's different approaches. Some have advocated for this lieutenant governor to become the governor. I talked to former Governor Gray Davis, who thought that the best approach would be to actually just have the ballot have one question. And it would basically be who should fill out the remainder of the term, and the governor could run to replace him or herself. So that's one possible reform. People have said, you know, make it harder to qualify for the ballot. So there's a whole host of ideas. I think we're going to see a lot of things thrown around. Actually, recently, lawmakers sent to Newsom's desk just this past week a bill that would ban the practice of paying signature gatherers by the signature, which would, in theory, make it harder to qualify not only recalls, but also referendums and initiatives for the ballot. So you're seeing a lot of different fronts happening at one time here.
Well, Emily, I appreciate you reminding us that it was the legislature that moved the date of the recall up, and it seems like it's getting harder in California to time elections, you know, before disasters like wildfires and pandemic spikes happen, but they did choose to do it ahead of November. But of all those reforms that you mentioned, could they be done by the legislature? Do they have to go back to the voters to approve it, since this is a voter-initiated process? And Emily, if you don't know the answer to that, I'm sure Dean Chemerinsky can weigh in, but...
Well, from my understanding, and feel free to jump in, Dean, if I'm wrong, my understanding is that the vast majority of those would have to be approved not only by 2/3 of the houses in both legislature, in both the Senate and the Assembly, but also by a majority of voters.
It depends on the reform. The number of signatures is set by California statute, and the California legislature can change that. The process of having the two votes and the highest vote getter on the second, with its plurality, become governor, that's pursuant to the California Constitution, and that would require a constitutional amendment. And so there are many reforms that the legislature can do because it's just by statute. Some things are set by the Constitution, and that's the ones that require a constitutional amendment.
Well, you're listening to State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 FM, KALW, San Francisco, Bay Area. I'm Grace Wan with Ethan Elkind, and we're talking about the Newsom recall. Do you feel that Governor Newsom deserves to be recalled? If so, who are you voting for? Give us a call at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org or send us a tweet. We're at State of Bay. I wanted to bring up a listener question. I'm just kind of pointing to the confusion about the ballot. This listener writes, do I need to choose a candidate for governor if I vote no on the recall? I find the ballot very confusing. Emily, what's the answer there?
Yeah, that's a question that we get all the time. And it is a confusing ballot in how it's structured. So the answer is no, you don't have to vote for a replacement candidate if you vote to keep the governor in office. However, in the chance that he is recalled, filling out that second question would allow you to have a say in the person that replaces him. So that's really a decision that's up to the individual voter. The California Democratic Party and the governor have been advocating for voters to leave that question blank. But I do think that does obscure the fact that you can support the governor and still vote for someone who, you know, could replace him if enough other people vote to kick him out.
And Dean Chemerinsky, there are a number of recall campaigns going on in the state, not just the governor's race, as we talked about in our first segment, including a recall campaign in San Francisco to oust our district attorney and a recall campaign to knock out the three board members of the San Francisco school district that are eligible to be knocked out, as we heard from Jill Tucker in our first segment. So it feels like these recalls are becoming more and more popular, and that we're now in this seemingly never-ending cycle of recalls at every level of elected official. What is your thought and thoughts in general about the impacts of this? Is this good for our democracy, or are we going too far at this point?
I think it's bad for our democracy. I think the recall diverts the office holder from the duties of the office. It's also very expensive. And that's why I was saying that I think there should be a much higher threshold for getting recalls on the ballot. What I'm very worried about is whenever somebody loses in a close election, they'll immediately try to undo the election by recall. Also, I think there's a lot of gamesmanship going on. The Republican Party doesn't think it has much chance of beating Gavin Newsom in November of 2022. So they thought a low turnout recall election gives them the best chance of Republican governor. I'm not suggesting eliminate recall elections, but we should take a lot more than 12% of the people who voted at the last election to get it onto the ballot.
Well, another listener writes, a few years ago, maybe even decades ago, California passed a term limits provision that would keep politicians from overstaying their welcome. Now we're trying to recall a politician before he even finishes his term. At some point, we're going to need to stand behind the decisions we've made as an electorate as to who can be in office. Unless a person has committed some gross crime or felony, there is no reason to recall them. Dean Chemerinsky, what do you think about the term limit issue as it plays into the recall? Isn't that what term limits are for, to keep people from overstaying their welcome, as this listener writes?
Well, there are term limits, including for the governor. Also, there's going to be an election in November 2022. I assume Gavin Newsom, if he withstands the recall, will run for re-election. And I accept that in extreme circumstances, when there is corruption, misconduct, neglect of duties, there can be a recall. But I don't think that the circumstances we have now begin to approach that. It's interesting, other states that have recall of governor specify the circumstances where it can occur. Alaska, for example, is one of the 19 states that allows recall, but it specifies four circumstances when there can be a recall. California doesn't do that. In California, if 12% of the number of people who voted the last election signed the petition, there's a recall. It's much too easy then.
Well, and Dean Chemerinsky, just on that point, what are the factors, if any, that you think really would justify a recall? Are there certain situations, like you just mentioned, Alaska might have four spelled out? What might those be in your mind?
Sure. Imagine corruption. I think that corruption would be a basis for removing somebody from office. I think it would be shown that there's gross neglect of duties. I think that would be a basis. And those are the kind of things in the Alaska law. It's analogous to when it comes to the president, vice president, or federal judge. They can impeach from office for treason or bribery or high crimes and misdemeanors, meaning a serious abuse of power. So I think that should be true for any office holder, but it should be a high threshold to remove somebody by impeachment or by recall rather than wait to the next election when the voters get to choose.
We have a lot of listener comments. Mira writes, during the shutdown, neither the Democrats nor the Republicans acknowledged that restrictions were basically a death sentence for those without means. If we live in a Darwinian state of nature, then we really ought to openly acknowledge this fact. As it stands, Gavin Newsom was our elected leader, and he did little or nothing to help those negatively impacted by the pandemic. I don't wish Newsom to be recalled, but I do think a little honesty about our present two-party lack of political representation for small businesses and the poor might be a healthy addition to this discussion. election. And I wanted to throw that to you, Emily. I mean, we are in a supermajority Democratic state in the legislature, so maybe there underlying this is a little frustration. If you are not in the majority party, how can you get your voice to be heard? And which picks up on something that Dean Chemerinsky said, which is that, you know, Republicans are using this as a way to put their imprint on California politics.
I think this honestly just speaks to a really fundamental frustration with politics in general, you know, which is not unique to California or even to the governor at all. I mean, I think, you know, you're seeing Democrats in California say, yes, you know, I think Democrats would do better than Republicans, but the Democrats still aren't doing too good. Right. And you are seeing a lot of things, a lot of priorities fail among progressive criminal justice reforms, environmental reforms. You're seeing hundreds of thousands of people who can't get their unemployment checks. Like, issues like that have nothing to do with political party. They guess they want people to be able to deliver on the most basic services to them. And whenever a party, regardless of what party that is, fails to do that, you're going to have people who are disaffected. And they might think to themselves, okay, yes, it would be worse if we had, you know, a Republican in there who, you know, doesn't believe in X, Y, or Z. That does not negate the fact that there is real discontent in California. And going to the point of, you know, corruption and issues like that that would make, you know, a recall allowed for the ballot, I think you are seeing a lot of voters who do feel like the governor is corrupt. And terms like that are vague and hard to define, but people's individual experiences are going to influence how they view a politician and a political party. So I don't think this caller's response, you know, sets her apart from anybody else. You're seeing this across the board in California among voters.
And Emily, just to stay with you, this race has gotten a lot of national attention, as you might imagine, because California is a big state, and it's a big deal to see a potential presidential candidate, maybe, and Gavin Newsom be under a recall like this. And we're now seeing Joe Biden in the Bay Area campaigning for Newsom. The vice president's been out. A lot of national figures have cut ads for him. What exactly are the stakes here from a national perspective? You know, I think a lot of people might say, well, you know, what's the big deal to send a message? And we'll have another election, you know, next year in November. So what is your response in terms of the national stakes here?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot. I mean, of course, you also had in New York recently, Andrew Cuomo stepped down as governor. And it's very interesting because both Cuomo and Newsom were kind of at the beginning of the pandemic, you know, seen as these rising Democratic stars in the party. And obviously Cuomo has kind of, you know, fallen to the side and is disgraced. And I think the idea to Democrats that they could lose California, which has always been seen as a stronghold, a blue state, is a very scary thought, especially because, as we've been talking about, there are elections in 2022 and there's going to be a scramble for those seats in the House. There's also the anxiety that if, you know, Senator Dianne Feinstein were to not be able to finish her term, that a Republican governor could then appoint a Republican U.S. senator, which could sway the entire balance of the Senate and, you know, make it basically impossible to pass Democratic bills. Already it's kind of challenging, but it would be even more challenging, obviously, if that were to go in favor of Republicans. And so I think those are some of the stakes that we're seeing here. And that's why you're seeing all these national figures come out and try to, you know, drum up voter support to keep Newsom in office.
Well, the Republicans, you know, best offense is defense. Defense is offense. The Republicans are already claiming that there might be fraud tinging this election. Elder has come out there claiming that there might be fraud in this recall. Dean Chemerinsky, how does that affect how the results are going to be accepted by the electorate when one side is already calling foul?
I worry that now, whenever a side loses an election, they're immediately going to say it was fraud. In fact, before the November 2020 election, Donald Trump was saying, if I lose, it's going to be fraud. And for the months afterwards, he was claiming it was fraud. Now we're hearing Larry Elder say, if I lose, it's fraud. And he'll certainly say this afterwards. I worry a great deal because it undermines the legitimacy of elections. Let's be clear. There is no evidence yet of fraud with regard to the recall election, with regard to the November 2020 presidential election. Every court to consider it found there was no evidence of fraud. And so I think that we should hold the politicians who falsely shout fraud accountable because they're really undermining our democracy.
All right.
Well, so, I just wanted to quickly follow up on that. It's bad to say that the election is already tainted or fraudulent. How do we stop people from saying that? I mean, as you're saying that we should hold people responsible, but how should we hold them responsible?
require proof of allegations. It's a very serious claim that there's been voter fraud. Prove it. With regard to the November 2020 election, it went to court. And judge after judge, Republican appointees and Democratic appointees, state and federal, said they found no evidence of fraud. And that's the message that we need to get out when that happens. And if Larry Elder is going to claim this fraud now, prove it.
All right. Well, we've got a couple listener comments. And Emily, I wanted to direct these to you. So first, this listener writes, California is facing some pretty serious problems right now. I can't imagine being led by a politician like Larry Elder, the other talk show host who seems to be in the lead, according to polls on the Republican side or on the sort of second step of the ballot initiative here. Elder doesn't believe in science and isn't in favor of choice. People need to vote. Another listener writes, I don't know what the outcome will be of this election, but I hope this is a wake-up call for Gavin Newsom that he can't just slide on his good looks and that dinners at French Laundry are not in step with how the public feels. What's I'm sure you get, you know, responses like that, you know, at Cal Matters. What's your thoughts about this kind of sentiment and these kinds of sentiments that you see out there among the electorate?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously people's reactions to this election are as diverse as each individual person. I mean, I had people emailing me saying, I'm going to vote for Larry Elder. I had people saying, I pray for Newsom every night. I actually got that email today. I pray for Newsom every night. You have people saying that the governor has, you know, ruined their livelihoods. You have people saying that if Larry Elder were to come in, or Kevin Faulkner, or Kevin Kiley, or John Cox, or any of these other candidates, their lives would be ruined. And so I think it really does run the gamut. I do think that regardless of the outcome, this election is going to be a wake-up call for the Democratic Party, because the fact that it did gather enough signatures, and you have Democratic consultants themselves saying, obviously, this is not only Republicans signing the ballot. I think that's just mathematically obvious, and talking to voters is obvious. And so I think that some of these issues are plaguing the state. I mean, the drought, the wildfires, the EDD problems. The fact is, there are a lot of problems in California, right? The homelessness problem. Are people's lives measurably getting better? I think that's going to be the metric that a lot of voters use, not only in this recall, but in 2022, to decide the fate of what's going to happen. And there have been quite a few voters I've talked to who said, I'm going to vote to keep Newsom in office in 2021, but I would want to see a different Democrat in 2022. And so I don't think that the governor's tribulations are over. And I think he does face a very real challenge, potentially, if the recall is close, of a more progressive candidate on his left emerging and really galvanizing voters who don't feel like things are getting better for them.
And Emily, now we mentioned Larry Elder a few times. Why do you think it's his message that's resonating? I mean, there are other Republicans on the ballot who are much more qualified, at least in terms of their political experience. Kevin Faulkner, for example, former mayor in San Diego. So why do you think Elder has sort of broken through as the opposition candidate here to Newsom?
Well, I think he had a bigger base to begin with, just in terms of like the popular media. I also think that what appeals to a lot of people is his bombastic personality, his refusal to kind of back down from controversial stances. And that is something that I, you know, sort of see in a lot of voters saw in former President Trump as well, where they like that about him. They like the fact that he, you know, would take those things, say those things that no one else would say. And so for better or for worse, I mean, I think people have kind of glommed onto him. And for Newsom, he has actually given Elder a lot more press coverage by kind of, you know, banking his entire campaign on why Elder would be terrible. And that sort of Newsom versus Elder narrative has really kind of come to the forefront, because he is the best epitome of Trumpism, and Newsom is campaigning against the specter of Trump. And until Elder came into the race, Kevin Faulkner, who's a moderate Republican and is, you know, pro-choice and things like that, was not really the right person to be Newsom's foil. And then you have Larry Elder, who's coming in and saying all the things that, you know, Newsom is campaigning against, and that sort of catapulted him into the forefront.
Well, Dean Chemerinsky, with the last minutes that we have, I wanted to just end with you on the reforms that you'd like to see. What are the likelihoods of them happening, and what more can people do if they want to get involved in that?
I agree with what Emily said earlier. I think the reforms are likely to happen. I think there's great frustration at this recall election. And I think with the Democratic legislature, I think at least the things that can be done by statute that don't require a constitutional amendment are likely to happen. And I think it's important for all of us as voters after September 14th, not just to be relieved if the recall fails, but to say we've got to take steps to make it harder to have recalls and have much more sensible recalls in the future.
Yes, and we'll have to leave it there. I want to thank you for joining us, Emily Hoven from CalMatters and Professor Erwin Chemerinsky from UC Berkeley.
And coming up after the break, we're going to be hearing from comedian Don Reed, who will be talking about his new one-man show, Going Out. So stay with us.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan.
And I'm Ethan Elkind. The COVID-19 pandemic brought the theater industry to a standstill, globally and locally. The Marsh, a theater in Berkeley, kept theater fans connected during the shutdown by live streaming their shows. In August, they reopened for live performances with the premiere of Going Out, Don Reed's solo show about the joys and fears of being out in the world before, during, and after the pandemic. So coming up next, you're going to hear our co-host Joseph Pache's interview with Don Reed.
Don Reed, welcome to State of the Bay.
Very glad to be here.
So we know that Going Out is about the joys and fears of being out in the world before, during, and after the pandemic. What were some of the experiences that inspired you to create this show?
Well, actually, I had written the show initially with the idea that it was going to be before, during, and after, and what a celebration show it would be. But now it's before, during, after, and during some more. I was inspired to write this show because I was all by myself. I'm not married. I don't have a girlfriend presently. And so I was in this room by myself and thinking about what was happening. And it was pretty terrifying to start, but then slowly but surely I realized I had to head down to Walgreens and get involved in a paper towel war. And I went down there and the area where paper towels was decimated, you know, and this guy came out. He's like, yeah, you know, the hoarders. What are you going to do? Store employee said that to me. But then later, about 10 minutes later, he came to the other side of the store and he said, here are the paper towels, wink, wink, that you ordered online 2 weeks ago. And I was like, yes, the paper towels I ordered 2 weeks ago. Of course, I had to go too far. Thank you very much for those. I've been waiting for those paper towels. But then later on, I saw the same employee in the parking lot. He had a shopping cart full of toilet paper, paper towels, cleaners, everything. He's like, yeah, that what I gave you was for my personal stash. I'm like, nobody thought that the employees were hoarding prior to the people doing the hoarding, but right. That's actually what was going on.
You know? I thought you were going to tell me he was like selling out of his trunk.
You know what? All I know is when the real apocalypse hits, I just got to find Larry from Walgreens and I'll be good. You know, but, it was fascinating being in a room by myself, and that's what brought it about, being alone for so long, and then flashing back.
So obviously, a lot of your shows over the years have been one-man shows, and they talk a lot about your personal history and your family history. What was unique or challenging about translating the experiences you had over the pandemic to this format?
It was challenging because almost all of my shows are autobiographical and they're about the past. And this is the first show that is a mashup of now, what's happening in the moment. And during that time, because I couldn't go out, I flash back on the times when I did go out. But also going out wasn't simply a party. One time in particular when my father took me to UC Berkeley. And he had a conga in his right hand and me on his shoulders. And there were protesters protesting the Vietnam War. And my father played the congas so hard with all his heart. And we're walking back to the car. I was sitting in the back seat and I realized my hands were wet. And my father had played the drum so hard that his hands bled. And it was right then that I understood that sometimes you go out to fight, to protest, so it'll be better when you go home. So I've got some warm beats in there, along with the hilarity of Larry from Walgreens.
And obviously there was plenty of very painful events that were beyond COVID. George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and countless other injustices that we became much more aware of and much more open about talking about. How did you reflect on that in the solitude? And then how did you bring it to the stage?
You know, everyone saw that very long tape of that officer pressing the life out of his neck. We saw that. And as I looked at it in that moment, terrifying, scared, a black man myself thinking, you know, how careful do I have to be safe and feel safe? But one of the good things that potentially came out of the pandemic is that we were all home and everyone saw that. When I was a young boy, my father was wailing in the living room. They killed him, baby. They killed him. And Martin Luther King had been shot. I was 8 years, 4 months, 11 days old. Never forget it. And I saw German shepherds and batons and black people marching in the streets. But when the George Floyd tragedy happened, I saw black people and thousands and thousands of white people as well, saying enough is enough. And maybe that moved the needle just enough. Mm.
And you talk about the show being before, so that's the Martin Luther King, during watching the protests, and after. Where do you see us as a society after these many months?
Well, the Cooties 19, as I call it, the pan, my wonderful gay friend calls it the pandy. He's like, oh my God, the pandy is killing us, the pandy. Had such a raw effect, and people were living unlike they ever did before. I know that I'm involved in some things now that I might not have been involved had it not occurred. And I've been approached by corporate America, and I created a one-person show specifically about diversity and inclusion. It's an imaginary EDI meeting, and I play different characters coming in the meeting. And the twist is on the end that they're all people I know. And so I don't know if I would have been approached by that if corporate America didn't have this huge mandate and push for diversity and inclusion, which was specifically tied to George Floyd, specifically tied to us all seeing it during the pandemic.
Wow. When is that coming out? Or are you only doing that for corporate audiences at this point?
I'm only doing it for corporate audiences, but I did get an offer that when I want to take a commercial, there's a woman who says, I can make this happen. It's a fascinating work. And the basic message behind it is, when it comes to diversity, equity, inclusion, it's not enough to put yourself in someone else's shoes. You have to put yourself inside this story.
Mm, wow. Well, we'll be looking out for that. But let's come back to the present. So
yes.
Congratulations on having your show be the reopening act for the Marsh in Berkeley. And they're not stupid. They know. They know what to do to bring the crowds back, right?
You know, you had
a long relationship with them.
Well, it feels amazing. I first started running at the Marsh in 2009. And I was coming down every weekend from the Tonight Show with Jay Leno. I was the audience warm-up opening act. And I drive down or fly down, do two shows, and get back fast by Monday before Jay goes, hey, where's Don? He's supposed to be up here doing something funny. And so because I couldn't go very far on the road and had to be back at the Tonight Show, I was forced to create new material because the same audiences were coming.
Right.
And so it created a really great fertile ground for me to keep building new works.
So it's been a long run of solo shows for you. In fact, you've been referred to as a solo show, a powerhouse. How did this become your central way of expressing your art?
For so many years, I only did stand-up that was impersonation and fantasy-driven. I never talked about my life. I never wanted to talk about my stepfather requiring me to be in that religion that rhymes with Jehovah's Witnesses. Never wanted to talk about my father being a pimp, but I didn't know it. I didn't want to reveal those things. So I kept myself for many years, all the way until 2006, actually, which is the lion's share of my career, in a solid income base, but kind of what they call happy guy performer, and not willing to accept that vulnerability, not willing to take it on. But then I was working at NBC with another guy, and he said, I'm working on a one-man show. I'm like, what is it about? He's like, about my parents, you know, my Jewish parents on my back all the time. And growing up on the East Coast, he said, where'd you grow up? I said, I grew up in Oakland in the 70s. My stepfather was a Jehovah's Witness, and my real father was a pimp. He said, you need to do a show about that. And so I started writing it in 1999, but I was afraid to do it. And so I didn't actually get on stage with it until 2006. Next thing you know, a guy saw it off Broadway in New York, came back to the Bay Area, and ran. But it's the most fulfilling thing I've ever done, solo work.
So Going Out runs through this weekend at the Marsh in Berkeley, the last performance being Sunday, September 19th. Don Reed, thank you so much for joining me this evening.
Actually, we're just going to take a break on the 19th for the Marsh Music Festival, and then I'm going to pick up after that and go until the wheels fall off.
Excellent. That's what I was hoping to hear. Thanks again.
Thank you so much.
That was Joseph Pace interviewing Don Reed about his new one-person show Going Out at the Marsh Theater in Berkeley. Tickets are available now at themarsh.org. And that's State of the Bay this week. To learn more about any of the topics we've covered tonight, visit the State of the Bay page at kalw.org.
We want to thank all of our guests and you, our listeners, this evening for being part of the conversation.
Ethan, what's on for the next week?
Well, next week at 6 o'clock, our usual time, we'll be talking about how to make cities more water resilient, and we'll also hear the latest from the Elizabeth Holmes Theranos trial. Grace, have you been following that trial at all?
I was very into that story, so I have been following the trial. I guess they're on a three-day break a juror got exposed to COVID, and then it will resume. So I'm excited I'm sort of interested to hear what happens next.
So we'll hopefully have an update on that, given the pause here. And I have to ask you, do you think that she was naive or was she deliberately lying?
I will leave judgment and let the jurors decide. So, but for next week, we'll find out more. And for a link to this and other State of the Bay shows, visit the State of the Bay page on kalw.org or email us at any time at stateofthebay@kalw.org.
Our engineer this evening was Dee Miner, and tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb and Chris Nooney.
Thanks to all of our listeners. Good night, and thanks for listening.